iHeartRadio.
All right, Friday. Another week has dragged to an end.
We have come around once again.
But it looks like it's going to be pretty beautiful. Tonight's a beautiful night, and we're here to celebrate the weekend, folks. I'm so glad you tuned in.
Good times. Come on.
Especially you. Thank you so much for tuning in. So glad to have you here with us for the next hour, I hope.
Yeah, you're the best.
Time for American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHBC. I'm Tom Ryan, the lovely wife and co-host Heidi Morales Ryan here as well. Of course, on Fridays, we call the show How Music Changed because we've got a whole bunch of topics that we intend to cover regarding the history of recorded music from its birth right on up until pretty much current day. And when I say from its birth, I mean it. We started show number one was about pretty much the birth of recorded music. But we can't continue that chronologically and stay back. Otherwise, we'd never get contemporary at all. So we cut it in half, and now we're up into the 60s. For this series, which is dedicated to the Monkees. And today is show five. And this is where it gets really interesting, according to me. There was so much stuff that was going on behind the scenes that we didn't know at the time. And we're going to get into that. I mean, in short, it was destined to come to a head. Asking four mature young men to, quote, pretend to be musicians on a television show is one thing. But releasing albums that set out to prove that they were incapable of making their own music was quite another, and the Monkees were fed up. Mike Nesmith, in particular, led the charge against Don Kirshner, and the rest of the band followed suit. When the smoke cleared, Kirshner was out, and the Monkees were suddenly determining their own destiny. The album Headquarters is the result of their efforts, and today's show covers the challenges that they faced while putting their genuine debut together. I'd call their third album the genuine debut because it's the first album where they had any
where
say.
They actually played.
And
everything.
They actually played. They laughed, they cried.
They played.
But they also got it done. The sad thing is that the world at large didn't really note the difference. But what the heck? Like I said, we were busy watching the TV show and having a good time. But let's take this from some of the liner notes then that covered these albums when they were re-released as a double set. That's where a lot of the extra tracks are coming from, by the way. For the four individuals that were pictured on the cover of the band's second album, More of the Monkees, which we covered in depth last week, the success meant very little because they were the biggest band in the world at that exact time. Mickey said, "To me, these were soundtrack albums to the show, and it wasn't my job. My job was to be an actor and to come in and sing the stuff when I was asked to do so. I had no problem with that. When I get an album, I'd go, wow, hey, look, another album." It wasn't until Mike and Peter started getting so upset about it that Davey and I started defending them and siding with them and getting concerned on their behalf. They were very upset about it because it wasn't the way that they were used to making music. The artist is the bottom line. The artist decides what songs are going to go on and in what order and who writes them and who produces them. So they, right from the beginning, were in a very, very difficult situation. They were compromising all the time. Well, this is the point where that compromise starts to end. And in fact, it starts to blow up.
It blowed up real nice, like.
TV Guide called it the Great Revolt of 67. But it wasn't a docudrama or a movie of the week. Tucked away amongst the obligatory crossword puzzle and casserole recipe, Dwight Whitney chronicled the Monkees' creative struggle with Svengali Don Kirshner. All the strange but true details were laid out leading up to the creation of their third album, Headquarters. This is from that article. The Monkees were artistically hung up because what they really craved was acceptance, wrote Whitney. They just didn't know how to go about getting it. Their pride was hurt. They were increasingly aware that it was the Beatles, the Birds, the Mamas and the Papas, to whom the musical world looked with genuine, if sometimes grudging, admiration. The Monkees felt like clowns. Thus, the boys were frustrated by the very system that enriched them. The love match between the boys and Kirshner was starting to decline, if it could ever have been called a love match at all. It began with Mike Nesmith. Mike fancied himself not only a musician, but a record producer and composer as well. Kirshner rode a narrow line between tolerating and patronizing the group. He listened, but not very hard, to the tapes they recorded on their own naive hope that one of them would please Donnie. He made vague promises that, the boys later claimed, he never kept. Clearly, a showdown was coming, and come it did. Before we get into the rest of that story, I want to play some of the demos that the Monkees were working on around this time. Things that never saw any album play at all. But the first track I'd like to play here is called Nine Times Blue. It's written by Mike Nesmith, and it's basically Mike doing everything. It's just Mike on lead vocals with an acoustic 12-string guitar. We'll play two tracks. That's what we're going to play. Nine Times Blue on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
Well, that was really great.
Hello.
Do 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 wow wow. And so once again, ladies and gentlemen, the Monkees broadcast from you high atop the beautiful Chicago Tower, looking like Greeks. You can read and look, sound, mouth, sound, ground, sound. We walk up the microphone and ask that musical question. So how's by you?
So, only difference between me and Peter is that I'm just stone legal. There's a certain something in the way you looked at me and said you'd stay that let me know that I was out of line. But I didn't know what else to do, and like a fool I tested you by demanding things of you which weren't mine. And now I feel like such a fool for making you crawl back to me. But you did it with such love that you're standing far above me and all I did to you. I'm sorry now, what can I do? I know that never in the world could I have found me such a girl who's there to pick me up before I fall. And if in the end we should go both our separate ways, I know the lessons I've learned here is worth it all. And now I feel like such a fool for making you crawl back to me. But you did it with such love that you're standing far above me and all I did to you. I'm sorry now, what can I do? I know that never in the world could I have found me such a girl who's there to pick me up before I fall. And if in the end we should go both our separate ways, I know the lessons I've learned here is worth it all.
Oh, right. That was recorded early in 1967, a track that even Mike didn't really pursue with the band. He had, I guess you could say, he had even better material that he knew that he could use with the band. But he also had some material like that was actually quite good and could have been used if he was in charge of producing the album, for example. But it's amazing the way that this progressed. This is, I mentioned that Showdown was coming and come it did. Well, let me tell you what happened, explains Don Kirshner some 40 years later. I go to the Beverly Hills Hotel. I had two bungalows there. I'm trying to imitate his voice. One for my equipment to rehearse with the Monkees and one for my family. I'm all excited. I've got four checks for the boys. These are guys who had no money. For $250,000 apiece. It's important money. It's unbelievable. So you'd think they'd give me a hug, right? We're outselling the Beatles. Beatles or no Beatles, there would be no hug for Donnie. Instead, the Monkees came bearing a list of demands. In short, they wanted to pick the songs they sang. Furthermore, they wanted to play on the songs they recorded. Essentially, they wanted to be the Monkees. Things got uncomfortable. They threw Donnie a bone. Kirshner could oversee their work and take his credit as music coordinator. Donnie danced around the subject while playing the band four new demos for their next session. He quickly forgot that the Monkees wanted to pick their own material. According to TV Guide, Nesmith then told Kirshner, "We could sing Happy Birthday with a beat and it would sell a million records. Your argument is no longer valid because we are the Monkees." Nesmith threatened to quit unless Kirshner gave the band some input. When told by Kirshner's attorney that he'd better check his contract, Nesmith smashed his fist through the wall of Kirshner's pricey suite, telling the attorney, "That could have been your face." With the room still shocked in silence, Nesmith stormed out.
"Ooh.
I was very impressed because I thought the Beverly Hills had pretty strong walls," chuckles Kirshner now, though he still seems shaken by the events. "Mike hit the wall in front of my wife, Sheila, and my mother-in-law, Joyce, which is embarrassing. It's like going to a graduation, a bar mitzvah, or a confirmation. You figure it's the happiest day of your life, right? They'd at least shake my hand, right? So that's what I experienced, and that's when I said to myself, that's the end for me. I'm going to do a group that doesn't talk back." Which he did. When he says that, he means it in full earnest seriousness, because the next group that he would become the music coordinator for would be the Archies. Literally
a cartoon
that could never talk back, that had to basically perform things exactly as he basically planned it. So that was Kirshner's next TV project, was doing...
He got his wish.
The Archies. Meanwhile, what's interesting is because Peter and Mike were making so much noise about having their own say with the music, Mickey began to not only support them, but began to get interested in recording songs himself. And he actually wrote a song that he performed on acoustic guitar. And he recorded it with his, I believe it's his sister, Coco Dolenz, doing the harmony vocals. They actually recorded two tracks. One is called Midnight Train, and another one is called She'll Be There. Here they are, back to back, as performed by Mickey and Coco Dolenz on 90.3 WHPC.
Or we could do...
Mickey, just do what they want.
Do both of these again.
Well, I'm an angry man, I sing an angry song. Tell you, honey, it won't be long. Well, I'll pack my bags, get out of here with my guitar and a case of beer. Well, I'm going north and I'm going south. Tell you, honey, better shut your mouth or I'll kick your head from here to hell. You better know I can do it well. Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, losing all my money, but it really ain't so funny, hon. Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, tell you what, baby, well, it better be moving on. Well, I really don't know where I'm going for sure. Ain't got a map and ain't no tour. I'm just heading out for the open sky. Who knows, I might even die. Well, don't you worry your pretty little head. I never give a damn what I did or said. That's why I'm packing and leave this place. Can't stand to look at your cheating face.
Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, losing all my money. Well, it really ain't so funny, hon. Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, tell you what, baby, well, you better be moving on.
Well, you treated me like a little boy and you played around like I was a toy. I guess you thought I've had to lose. Look who's crying, guess you lose.
Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, losing all my money. Well, it really ain't so funny, hon. Midnight train, rambling, rambling all night long. I'm a gambling, gambling, tell you what, baby, well, you better be moving on. Midnight train, rambling, rambling, all night long. I'm gambling, gambling, losing all my money. Well, it really ain't so funny, hun. Midnight train, rambling, rambling, all night long. I'm gambling, gambling, tell you what, and baby, well, you better be moving on.
that train rambling on along. I'm gambling, lose no money, but it really ain't funny, hun. In that train rambling on that long. I'm gambling, tell you what, big boy, better be moving on. It's about that time, better be moving on. Get out of here, you better be moving on. That song she wrote, you better be moving on. When your dreams have died around you, she'll be there. When you need a hand to guide you, she'll be there. And when you feel rejected, 'cause life is not what you expected, I know that she'll be there. If I hadn't lied and cheated, she'd be here. She wasn't so mistreated, she'd be here. And if you don't abuse her, I know you'll never ever lose her, and she will always be there. I was too late to discover I really did love her, but now her place is with you, and I must face it, it's over with me.
Back then, we didn't even believe that Mickey ever really knew how to play drums. That's one thing.
Right.
But there's evidence that, I mean, not only that, but he was able to play guitar quite well. I mean, that's him playing guitar, accompanying himself. He wrote the first song. I don't know who wrote the second song. But that was like a pretty good like Dylan comedy like routine thing that he did there with his sister Coco singing. And so... It didn't take him long to learn how to play the drums properly, which is why he was able to play drums quite admirably on the
Because he
the
was
Al-Med
a musician
quarters.
Already.
Yeah, he already had some of that under his belt. He just didn't basically, he saw himself as an actor because he was a child actor. He was in a TV series called Circus Boy for a while, and he just figured, okay, I'm an actor. Peter and Mike are musicians. I'm an actor. I'm not going to worry about it. But now here's Mickey basically being part of like the musical front that the Monkees can present. So back to the story. According to Mike, here's words from Mike Nesmith. It was a full-on confrontation between me and Don Kirshner. The Monkees series creators, Bert Schneider and Bob Raffleson, instantly got it. They said, you know, you're right. What do you think about you guys playing together as a band? I said, well, what you're basically asking to have happen here is a really good tennis player and a really good football player and a really good basketball player and a really good golfer to get together and all play baseball. We're all good athletes, but we don't play the same sport. It's weird. You're not going to make a band out of this. We could give it a try. There's nothing wrong with doing that. Maybe make a little garage band music. Now, the reason Mike is saying that is because Mike was writing and recording songs already before he was a Monkee, and he had a very distinctive Texas sound to what he was doing. And if he was going to be recording a solo album or making his own music, you could be quite sure that it wouldn't be Davy Jones that he would hire to join the band. for example. And no offense to any of them, including Mickey or Peter, but they all would want to do things somewhat differently. Mike is beginning to like let it sink in that he could perhaps learn to compromise and work with the other guys because of what the situation demanded. But here's an example of a song that Mike was putting down actually pre-Monkees, and it actually became a hit for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. They covered a Mike Nesmith song pre-Monkees.
That's pretty cool.
And it was called Some of Shelley's Blues on 90.3 WHPC, as performed by Mike here.
Don't think that you'll convince me. Now you've said before falling in love again you'd rather be dead. 'Cause when someone breaks your heart you cry your eyes red. But there's nothing so hard about the life that you live. As far as I can see, there's no reason for goodbyes. You're just running scared, and that's something I won't buy. So you lose, I won't let you go with nothing to show but more blue. And all this talk about leaving is strictly bad news. So you settle down and stay with the man that loves you. About leaving is strictly bad news. So you settle down and stay with the man that loves you. Yes, you settle down and stay with the man that loves you. Yes, you settle down and stay with me, baby.
Was a jangly number.
Right. I mean, it's a demo, but I mean, it was a demo that resulted in a hit for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So Mike is doing the math in his head and he's thinking about, okay, you know, maybe we should do this band thing. This is what this is really all about. So to that end, he enlisted the help of a former Turtles, the Turtles bass player, Chip Douglas, to produce the Monkees' first group recordings. Now, though Douglas had arranged the Turtles' biggest hit record, Happy Together, he, like the Monkees, had no prior experience as a record producer. Everybody was being a novice at this point. No matter, Nesmith told Douglas, he'd teach him how to produce records. Because the main thing I remember him telling me was, well, if you think it has enough of the highs on it, just add more, said Chip Douglas of Nesmith's technical advice. The engineer will tell you it's fine, we've got enough highs, but don't believe him. Add more highs to everything. That was the main upshot of what Mike Nesmith tried to tell me. Despite this questionable recommendation, Chip took his job very seriously and set about taping the group fresh from a series of weekend concerts. Now, the band was playing live at this point, and they were on stage, the four of them, playing their own instruments live. That didn't convince anybody yet either. They just couldn't get respect. So their first effort together, a song written by Baker Knight called She's So Far Out, She's In, fell apart. I don't have any recorded evidence of that. Maybe a good thing. But slowly, the group sound came together. And you heard it. They heard it first on an early version of a Mike Nesmith song called The Girl I Knew Somewhere. And also on a Bill Martin song called All of Your Toys. The first sign that the Monkees really might be able to record their own music. Let's hear these two early versions of these tracks for what would eventually lead to the sessions for their third album. On 90.3 WHPC, first an early version of The Girl I Knew Somewhere, followed by All of Your Toys.
You tell me that you've never been this way before. You tell me things I know that I've heard somewhere. You're standing in the places and you're staring down through faces that bring to mind traces of a girl that I knew somewhere. I just can't put my finger on what it is that says to me, watch out, don't believe her. I can't give any reasons, girl, my thoughts are bound down in a whirl. I just can't think who in the world was that girl. I know I met her somewhere, somehow the same thing was done. Someone somewhere did me the same wrong. My dear, I just can't take this chance again. My fingers are still burning from the last time. And if your love was not a game, I only have myself to blame. That's as maybe I can't explain. Just ask the girl that I knew somewhere. And if your love was not a game, I only have myself to blame.
Now, with those two tracks, the Monkees had a pretty firm grip on what they were trying to do. And I think that they started to feel a bit confident about their ability to create their own album with those two tracks and them doing all of the work on it with Chip Douglas. I also, at this point, want to credit Andrew Sandoval, because he's the person who wrote the liner notes that I'm relying on for most of the story. So I just want to give credit to Andrew at that point.
Credit where credit is due.
Right. So, despite the fact that those two songs came out so well, there were problems. This is according to Chip Douglas. He goes, the publishing probably wasn't available on All of Your Toys, which was the reason why it was quickly nixed for release. That killed several things. Without Screen Gems owning the publishing, they didn't want to do it because they wanted to make money on all sides. So they didn't want the Monkees to bring songs in unless it was a Screen Gems song. Moreover, the group's take on The Girl That I Knew Somewhere, with Nesmith singing lead, as we just heard, was deemed unsuitable for single release. Not sure why. So while the Monkees went back to the drawing board to come up with an acceptable single, Kirshner went into overdrive back in New York, producing nearly a full album's worth of backing tracks without the group.
Wow.
On the same day that the Monkees played to almost 14,000 fans at Phoenix's Memorial Coliseum, producer Jeff Barry, under the auspices of Don Kirshner, was 3,000 miles away at RCA in New York City, turning out six backing tracks. Among these were two that were written by Jeff Barry himself, called 99 Pounds and You Can't Tie a Mustang Down. We'll play both of those songs now. By the way, what they had to do at this point, Davey was still a little bit on the fence and still basically feeling very much the actor. He was the only Monkee at this point that Kirshner was interested in, so he would pay to have Davey fly to New York in between concerts to record his voice on top of these productions. So that's what you're going to hear here with Jeff Barry's 99 Pounds and You Can't Tie a Mustang Down on 90.3 WHPC.
She can hang you up every night and get you so tight.
That's two tracks from the Don Kirshner New York sessions, produced by Jeff Barry, who was obviously a very good songwriter. He wrote a lot of hits. Whoops. He wrote a lot of hits with, that's all right, Ellie Greenwich. But in fact, there were two other songs that were recorded at that exact same session. Well, here's the story for this. By the end of January 1967, Kirshner had amassed 15 newly recorded tracks for the group. Now all he needed was their voices. Lucky for him, Davy Jones had remained close to Donnie through the group's turmoil. "The only guy who appreciated appreciative to me was Davy Jones," says Kirshner today. During a weekend trip to New York City, Davy left his fellow monkeys and their new producer, Chip Douglas, to meet Jeff Barry at RCA Studios. He was then cajoled into hurriedly adding his voice to four songs before leaving the session. The hand claps and backing vocals would be left to Barry and his studio crew. No monkey had anything to do with this. One of the songs ended up being an original B-side of their next single, which is She Hangs Out, which was written by Ellie Greenwich and Barry, and also a Neil Diamond song called Love to Love. Here they are, back to back on 90.3 WHPC.
Keep an eye on her. I on her. Do they run? the thing that needs one to thrive on. Then it grows, at least that's what I've been told. You can't love someone if you find that all you get in return is a heart that's cold. They say you need love to love. You gotta have love to love. They all say it works that way, but if it's true, why do I love you? Why do I love you? Seems like you keep trying to break me. You do things designed just to make me cry. And I've heard if warm lips don't touch you, love won't grow no matter how much you try. They say you need love to love. You gotta have love to love. They all say it works that way, but if it's true, why do I love you? Why do I love you?
It's a weird thing to consider, but at this point in time now, we don't know which one is the rebel. Is it the band recording their own songs, or is it Don Kirshner trying to record the album without
trying to
the
force
band
his will on
in New York, right? I mean, yeah, they're both being weird at this point, right? But on the face of things, Don Kirshner was back in business. I mean, at least almost. A promise that he had made to Neil Diamond came back to haunt him at this point in time in early 1967. You know, I had the aggravation of committing to Neil Diamond after I'm a Believer that I would make one of his songs the Monkees' next single. That's my Don Kirshner interpretation.
I know.
The problem was that Donnie couldn't sense that Neil Diamond's A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You was rather ordinary and certainly not a number one. I should say that he could sense that. Kirshner's troubles didn't end there. They told me that they would fire me if I put it out, he says, of Columbia Pictures' reaction to his choice for the Monkees' third single. The company, and I don't know what choice he had anyway, though, because he didn't have a ton of material and everything was like just Davy, right? So the company, run by the show creator Bert Schneider's father, wanted Kirshner to give the boys a shot with one of their own songs.
Okay.
Because I thought they'd have a parade for me, thank me for my work. I was working around the clock in the studio for 30, 40 hours. You know, whatever it took to get the albums done for the thing. But no appreciation. I was uptight. So uptight that I was determined. So, by the time the Monkees had regrouped to cut an acceptable take of The Girl I Knew Somewhere, this time with Mickey on lead vocals, for single release, that's what the Monkees wanted to do, Kirshner had already mastered and pressed records in Canada of what he deemed their next 45 to be. A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You on the A side, the Neil Diamond song that even he didn't believe in, coupled with She Hangs Out, which we just heard, on the B side. As Nesmith recalls, Kirshner set his heels, and when it came time to issuing a group-created recording, he said, quote, I'm not gonna do it, which ultimately cost Kirshner his job. They fired him. Only
Oopsie.
Days later, the Monkees' third single was repressed in the United States this time with Nesmith's The Girl I Knew Somewhere on the flip side of A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. As TV Guide put it in that article, Kirshner was out, Flower Power was in. Here's both sides of the Monkees' third hit single on 90.3 WHPC. We'll play Mike Nesmith's song first, as performed by Mickey, and then the hit.
Time.
this is as good a time as ever to mention, if you're enjoying this show, if you like listening to American Radio, hey, I'm talking over here. But if you enjoy this show, stay tuned for the next hour as well. Stick around for Steve Mangiaracina, plays lost hits and misses from rock era, hits from obscure artists, forgotten songs by rock and roll
superstars.
I just want
to tell you that was still part of track 13, and it's got a huge tag on the end of it. But
it's a weird, noisy part. I think I remember that for no good reason. Hey, if you listen to Steve, you might even hear some Pit Clark. Who knows? But we got time for one more, and we'll finish up with an album track, since we didn't really get to the album itself. By the end of February 1967, Chip Douglas was put to work making a full album with the group. Don Kirshner got fired, and it looked like we had to continue, said Douglas. Pretty soon, Lester Hill was brought in as Don Kirshner's replacement, and he said, well, look, we've got to sync new songs into the show, and we've got to have this record out quickly, so let's all get to work. So they took off from the TV show for 6 weeks and went into Studio C at RCA and concentrated on making an album. Now, the difference between the group's innocent pop and homespun folk rock stands in stark contrast to Kirshner's more contrived concoctions. I think that's exactly what you said, Heidi. Didn't you say the song sounded very contrived?
Yes, formulaic.
Yeah. If anything, the band returned to the sound that singer-songwriters Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart had really debuted with the band on their first album. Among one of the first tracks that was taped for the Headquarters album that actually made the record was Mike Nesmith's country tune, Sunny Girlfriend. We'll end our show with that today, and we'll be back with the rest of Monkey's Headquarters next week. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next Friday.
She owns and operates her own sunshine factory. Oh, painting smiles on dolls and then on me. She's my sunny girlfriend and personality. Well, she's got a book that tells about everybody's past, and she can make you slow while making your mind move fast. She's my sunny girlfriend, and she is never less. At night, gazing down through eyes as bright as wonder. She can send you on your way to everywhere. She's only started after you think that she is there. She's my sunny girlfriend.